Working Cows Podcast, episode 113.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy everybody, it's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And today, this episode is brought to you by Beefmaster Breeders United. If you're interested in incorporating Beefmaster genetics into your herd, check out beefmasters.org. Today I'm really excited to be joined by David Neeson, very excited to talk to him about common mistakes that people make in their horsemanship, made by people who are around horses regularly, and also some really great stuff I'd like to talk to him about reading the body language of a horse. So, David, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
You bet, Clay. Glad to be here. I guess, when it comes down to ranchers, there's always two different types of ranchers. There's the pickup truck and the feed sack rancher, and then there's the guy that still kind of wants to do it more horseback in the old way. And
right. And
sometimes the two cross over, and you'll get a guy that predominantly handles his cattle with a feed sack or a feed truck, even depending on what scale he's operating on. But sometimes, he still wants to own a horse and cling to that lifestyle. And there's different mindsets with those guys a lot of times too, because I deal with those guys too, being a day working cowboy. I run into those guys. I'll have the owners that don't go with us at all. They just want us to pin their cows and work them. And then there's the guys that want to be right there in the middle of it with us, riding their horse and getting in on the action as well. And so it kind of depends. Kind of where I start with a lot of people, regardless what their background is, ranching or just if they're, got a backyard pet, is to be realistic with yourself about what your background is. I get a lot of people go, well, my grandfather had horses, I know what I'm doing. And I tell people all the time, this stuff isn't a heritable trait. you aren't blessed with the ability and the knowledge of horses just because your grandfather had them and maybe rode once or twice as a kid and that sort of thing. Being realistic with yourself and about your knowledge. And then, as far as if you have any fears of a horse in general and that sort of thing. And a lot of that stuff can be alleviated, just on purchase, being realistic purchase wise. A lot of people want to go with a young horse because it's cheaper and think, well, either we'll learn together or I'll train it. And, if you're green and don't know much about a horse, a green horse is a bad combination with a green rider trying to teach it. It's like the blind leading the blind. But surprisingly, a lot of people go that route. And then, if you are more experienced, but you necessarily haven't ever started or trained your own horse, a young horse is not necessarily a good fit either, because even though you have some knowledge, I tell people all the time, a young, unstarted or just barely started colt is almost a different species of animal from a broke finished horse. They just don't have the experience. They haven't been out there and seen the real world. And something as simple as a jackrabbit jumping up out of the brush and running across in front of them could cause a young horse to spook and startle them. And if you're sitting there kind of counting cows and not paying attention, they can jump out from under you pretty fast. Whereas a more seasoned, experienced horse is going to take that stuff in stride. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, that's where it comes back to just the initial purchase of making sure you get the right fit. If you already have a horse and you're having issues, that's a whole different animal too, as far as where you start and what you do. But general warm-up tricks and tips of not being too proud to maybe, we call it jipping him around, but, taking a horse on the end of a bridle rein and just, lunging him around, three or four times either way and let him, pull that cinch up in increments. Don't just cut him in half the first time and let him feel that squeeze coming on, let him move in between and stuff like that. And that you can kind of read him, kind of almost like a pre-flight checklist. Like if you were an airplane pilot, you're not just going to get in and turn the key on and throttle back and take off. You're going to go through all your maneuvers and make sure the flaps work and the rudder works and all that, the radio works and that kind of stuff. So just little things of like pulling the horse's head around before you get on, tipping his nose and walking into his hip and seeing how he acts when he moves away from you. if he's real stiff and hopping and kind of bouncing and stiff-legged or real stiff in his neck and doesn't want to bend. But if he just kind of mellow and bends and steps away from you quietly and his head's low, you know, he's probably all right, that sort of thing. But and then also, when's the last time you rode him? You know, has it been a few days? Has it been a few months? Has it been a few years? And that is always strange to me when people treat a horse more like a four-wheeler or something. You know, you can't leave them in the barn for 6-8 months and then go catch them up, crank them up, and step on and go. They're not going to, you know, they do have emotions, and they are very emotional beings. And a lot of people take that for granted. They assume that this horse should just act right because I said so. Because I said, whoa, he ought to quit moving his feet. You know, I don't know how many old timers I've heard growling at their horse, whoa, whoa, God dang it. I said, whoa, stand still. You know, and they don't speak English to begin with. And now you're growling at them. You sound like a mountain lion or a grizzly bear. And now they're really panicked and worrying. So just having a little bit of patience and understanding, if you haven't been riding them on a regular basis and they hadn't been having a steady diet of work and exercise, and they're a little overweight, they're going to be frisky and froggy, and you pull that cinch tight, you know, they might hump up and bounce around a little bit. Sometimes that's enough to scare people away for the day, and they think, well, I'll just put him up and go get the four-wheeler after all. And some people are, you know, a little more macho about it, and they're thinking, well, I'll just ride it out of him. It just depends on your skill level. If you have the skill level to step aboard and bronc it out and take off across pasture while he's bucking and bawling, then by all means, go for it. But if you don't, and you want a little more safety, and it's not your normal day-to-day job, you know, you're more tending to cattle and working beside the chute, and getting horseback is something you do on a less frequent basis, is no pride lost at all in putting that guy in a pen and letting him run around for 5 or 10 minutes and just kind of get the fresh knocked off of him. And you don't have to have a round pen. I get a lot of people saying that too, like, well, I just don't have a round pen. I can't afford to do that. That's extra. Well, if you're a rancher, more than likely you've got some pen space for your cattle. And that pen doesn't need to be more than, you know, 40, 50 feet square or something like that. And it doesn't have to be perfectly square. It could be rectangle. You just want it big enough that that horse can get in there and move around you without you being in danger of him coming over the top of you. That's all you're looking at. You can just kind of just let him move and kind of push on him a little bit as far as slapping your leg, maybe swing a rope, just let him move. And if he bucks a little, that's good, because he's going to get tired from bucking. And if he doesn't buck, then you know where he stands. You know, he's probably a little calmer and ready to go.
What do you think is the difference between a horseman and a person who rides horses?
Boy, that's a great question, because there's a lot of that. You know, a person that just rides a horse really tends to treat that horse like a four-wheeler or some sort of vehicular machine. You know, they want to just be able to ride him whenever they want to. They're in it for their enjoyment and their pleasure. They want to be able to just go catch him. They don't really want anything to go wrong, and they don't want to have to plan ahead for something that might go wrong. And they want to get on and just go. And when they're done, they want to get off and just quit. And that's understandable. You know, people are busy and people have short attention spans. But a horseman is going to be more in it for the horse. You know, I'm not saying that. Not at all am I talking about a person that babies a horse and baby dolls a horse and sugar cubes and peppermint sticks and all that kind of stuff. I mean, a horseman really cares about the welfare and the well-being of his horse. He kind of takes the horse's emotional state into account as he works with him through the day. It doesn't mean he won't push on him. It doesn't mean he doesn't ask him for anything, but he's more aware of the horse's point of view, I guess you'd say. You know, sometimes people come up to a creek and a horse maybe balks and doesn't want to go across. And maybe it's even a creek they've crossed before, but maybe the horse noticed something different that day, or maybe there's a storm rolling in, but the person hadn't really checked the weather that morning and they're not really aware of it yet. Backing off in the distance, the clouds are building, the wind's starting to pick up a little bit. The horses pick up on that stuff, and it changes how they perceive their surroundings. And so a person that just rides a horse is going to ride up to that water and immediately get aggravated and go to kicking or spanking or just pulling or jabbering, you know, even just, go on, get across this creek. You know, I said, do it. And a horseman is going to kind of look around and go, what's going on? Why isn't this horse wanting to cross this water today? And again, not babying them, but just trying to be more empathetic, I guess would be the best description of, I'm going to sit here, we're going to cross this water, but it might take us an hour and a half, and I'm okay with that. You know, I got other things to do, but this is more important at this point, that I don't blow this horse up and make him actually afraid of this water by kicking and spanking and jerking on him right now when he's clearly bothered by something. It, again, you don't let him off the hook just because he's bothered, but you figure out a way to help him push through what's bothering him.
Yeah, I think it's kind of what you're talking about is the idea of looking at a horse as a partner in the work, not just a tool.
Definitely. Most definitely. And they can be such a valuable tool because, man, I can't tell you the wrecks I've been in or almost been in, and the horse that was with me got me through it, you know, not discounting anything that the Lord might have done to get us out of it too. But a four-wheeler would have put no effort into, you know, taking the hit or taking the jerk or not falling over on me, rolling off of a cliff bank, going down in a steep creek bank, you know. But whereas a horse will fight and struggle and try to stay upright, or if I've roped something that's a little too big, you know, still scrambling and struggling, trying to stay on his feet and hold whatever it is that I've got, you know, until either I can tie it down or till somebody can bring me a trailer so that we can get it loaded and that sort of thing. And cutting and sorting, you know, prowling through yearlings, looking for sick ones. I've had horses that could kind of almost smell them. You can almost be in a pen full of sick calves and feel a horse kind of tugging you in the direction of one that, you know, we're clearly talking about a horse that's done it a lot. You know, they just start to associate the things that they've noticed in their environment and what I do in relationship. You know, the same goes for a horse that's doctored a lot, but has also had to sort a lot. If I don't take my rope down, my horses know that they're generally kind of in sorting mode. They need to be acting more like a cutting horse and not let a cow get by them. But once I reach up and start taking my loops down and building a loop, they change and they know that it's game on and they're fixing to lay their ears back and run to one and run hard. You know, so they know from little signals that we give them that we don't even realize we're giving them. And you're just not going to get that out of a machine. You know, I've had lots of discussions with people that swear they can do everything on a four-wheeler, I can do on a horse, and I won't go into that here, but it's clearly not. Clearly not.
Yeah, well, and you know, I want to come back to what you were just saying because I think it's important. But you know, I've talked to some people who've pretty nearly gone broke ranching, and they said, you know, when we had to destock in a major way, we decided we were going to do everything we could do to make ranching as fun as possible from here on out. And so we got rid of the four-wheelers and we bought horses because it was a more fun way for our family to ranch together. And, you know, so I think that there's something to be said for wanting to enjoy the process and partnering with that animal in a way that can make it a more fun endeavor to go out on.
Most definitely.
So I guess what I wanted to come back around to there is, what are some of the senses that a horse is using that people might not be aware of, and how can they make sure that they are not sending mixed signals? You know, I think of people who, you know, kind of like you were talking about, want the horse to stand still, but to get them to stand still, they're whipping them and telling them,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
So what are some of the senses that horses are using that can, that people maybe aren't aware of that they can take advantage of and make sure that they're paying attention?
Yeah, boy, that is another really good question. You're hitting them out of the park. A horse is more aware of his surroundings than we as humans will ever be. We are predators and we pay attention when we want to be. Now, I think maybe our ancestors more in like a caveman setting might have paid more attention to saber-toothed tigers and wolves roaming around. But in our day and time, I see a lot of human beings around me that are oblivious to their environment. And a horse is not. They are hardwired from centuries of, if they didn't pay attention, they didn't stay alive. And that's another thing where I don't think humans give them enough credit for being an emotional feeling being, not a machine. And what I mean is, if you've ever seen a horse throw his head up in the air all of a sudden and look way off with a faraway look, you're like, what are you looking at? You know, you can feel them getting tense underneath you and their ears are locked forward. They've seen something. And just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. It doesn't mean that it's a real threat. It just means that it's something that got their attention and they feel the need to watch it until they feel okay about it. And that a lot of times will either unnerve people or it'll have the opposite effect and it'll irritate people. And that's where they'll go to pulling on them and saying, pay attention, you know, trying to pull their attention away from it. Well, if the horse is really worried about it and you try to pull their attention away from it, they're going to get more worried about it, you know? And so their vision is very good, but they do focus by elevating and lowering their head. I don't know that a lot of people realize that, but when a horse sees something off in the distance, he's going to really raise his head way up and kind of point his nose out. And when a horse sees something up close that bothers him, he drops his head down low to investigate it. And then, you know, just kind of his normal everyday travel, his head's more in a low, moderate position. Their hearing is excellent. You know, they hear things that we don't necessarily hear. They're also silent. You know, if you ever watched it or had an opportunity to watch, yeah, you'll hear a little squealing now and then if they're playing, or a baby may call to its mother. But in general, a herd of horses is silent. And that's the same reason. If they were out there jabbering like a bunch of old hens clucking, they wouldn't hear mountain lions sneaking up on them. You know, they wouldn't be paying attention to the scent that they caught on the breeze. And they definitely pick up on scent. Taking care of as many yearlings as I had, periodically you'll ride across a dead that might have been there for a while. And I have literally seen horses that, you know, where the carcass was maybe 10 feet away from me, and I knew it was there because it was in the waving grass, but the horse hadn't really seen it. And as I rode by it, the breeze blew the smell of death into the horse's nose, and then they snorted and looked and saw it and actually dropped their head and went to bucking, trying to get away from, because it startled them. And they didn't even realize it till the smell hit their nose. So definitely they, you know, vision, hearing, and smell are all extremely, extremely acute. But the overall really sensitivity is their feeling. Like you said, you know, we're getting on their back, we're touching them, we're handling them. And I think a lot of people tend to be way heavier handed than they realize, or than is necessary. And then we build that into a horse. You know, a horse wants to be pretty light and pretty soft. But a lot of people are just, I don't necessarily think it's conscious, but just subconsciously, they're a little careless with how they handle a horse and how much they pull on it and how hard they pull on it or how hard they think they need to pull on it. And that just makes a horse heavier. You know, if he just gets used to everything being hard and heavy around him, he just becomes more and more dull. But he wants to be sensitive. You know, if he can feel a fly land on his butt, he can feel the weight of our bodies on his back and the leg pressure and the reins and the bit in his mouth. You know, we don't have to pull with 10 pounds of pressure on everything we do. And you might be listening to this right now and going, oh yeah, but you don't know old Ronnie, that sucker will run off and you gotta have a big, well, that's probably more of a case of, you know, what somebody built into him. Either the foundational start wasn't good, or someone's ridden him really heavy and the horse has just gotten used to you know, someone using the bridle reins as a set of handlebars, and they definitely shouldn't be handlebars. But, you know, you get people that don't ride a lot and they're just not physically conditioned. Their trunk muscles, their core muscles are not strong enough so that they have an independent seat to stay upright on that horse, regardless of what gait he's traveling in. And when things get a little fast or they get a little bumpy, they just instinctively starting to increase their, tighten their grip on their reins, in an effort to use them like handlebars, like you would on a bicycle or a motorcycle or even a car on a bumpy road, you know. But it, the more you do that, the more you just teach that horse that the pull on my face doesn't mean anything. And so, yeah, their sensitivity and their awareness. And then on back to their vision, which I kind of skipped briefly, is, you know, their eyes, because like I said in the beginning, they're a prey animal. And their eyes are set on the sides of their head. And I don't think a lot of people really have ever taken that into consideration. But just like a cow, and if you've ever seen any of Temple Grandin's stuff, she is really good about talking about that. But a horse's eyes are set just like a cow on the side of their head, whereas ours are on the front of our head. And we think about what's directly in front of us. And a horse is able to see in front of him, out to the side of him, and out behind him. And just because he sees it in his left side, you know, doesn't mean it's necessarily affecting what he's thinking on his right side. So that's where they can be startled. If they've seen you on the left side, but suddenly you switch sides and it spooks them because of you just kind of popped up in there, or somebody walked up on them all of a sudden, they didn't necessarily notice that. There's also a cone in front of them. And I know Temple has some stuff out there that she's drawn where it has that cone out in front of a cow. A horse is exactly the same way. There is a certain distance, about 4 to 5 feet out in front of a horse, that they can't see directly in front of them. So a lot of people, you'll see people reach up in front of a horse to pet them real suddenly, like they want to rub that horse's forehead. Mm-hmm. Well, the horse can't see your hand. And so if he doesn't have a lot of trust in you, if you're someone he's never met and he's not been around, or maybe he's young, and you suddenly reach up in front of him to pet his nose or pet his forehead, he can't see your hand, and that will startle him and make him fling his head. But, you know, if you kind of start back at his shoulder and work your way up his neck and down his cheek and then up on his nose, he can see you coming and he can feel you. And so it's less startling. And the same thing behind a horse. You know, that's where people get kicked, is because that cone actually extends beyond a greater distance behind them than it does in front of them, of where they can't see. And so when you're sitting on their back, you're actually in that cone where they cannot see. And so now your hands, if you stick your hands out to the side, your hands will be in that cone. You know, so I've seen guys literally be riding their horse and they've been on him for an hour, but all of a sudden, you know, they feel kind of sweaty and they pull their cowboy hat on to wipe sweat off their forehead, and that white straw hat or something kind of all of a sudden pops into that horse's vision out to the side. And, you know, that horse snorts and blows sideways like, what in the world was – and they're completely caught off guard by it. And that has to do with not taking into consideration how the horse sees and how his vision is actually designed.
Let's just continue on as if we're talking to horsemen today. And what are some of the most common mistakes you see them making, whether it's, you know, as you said earlier, pre-launch, or if it's something that they do while they're riding? Or you can pick them, pick one mistake in each facet if you want, pre, during, and after, whatever. Right. But what are some of the most common mistakes you see them making?
I think one of the most common is going to be overfeeding their horses. Everybody wants a fat, slick, pretty horse. And I don't deny that either. I like a fat, pretty, slick one too. But if you're not riding them regularly, you're clearly going to have problems because you're over-energizing them. They've got too many calories and they need to burn those off. And so now you end up with an overfed horse that's been under exercise. And so that can just be a dangerous combination, actually. You know, as far as, you know, outside of beyond that, that sounds pretty elementary and like, well, duh. But surprisingly, a lot of people do that. The other one is being inconsistent with their horses. I've got some people that just sent me a horse over the weekend, and they just sent me one. I had it for about 9 months, and they were wanting to compete on this horse and had it for 9 months. And when they got here with it, it was doing the same thing this horse is doing. And these people are horsemen. They've been in horses and involved with horses at a competition level since the daughter was in 4-H as a young girl with my wife. And now she's an adult and grown and has kids of her own and her mother, and they're getting back into showing. So they know horses. They've really been into horses at a high level. And both of these horses, as soon as they get off the trailer, they want to stick their head down on the ground and graze. And when you try to pull on the halter and the lead rope, the horses fight you to keep their head down and won't, you know, they won't just pick their head up and walk off and lead and follow real quiet and obediently without me having to really pull. And those are horsemen that should know better. But just the inconsistency of allowing your horse to graze here and there, and it's cute and it's sweet to go walk, hand graze them. I'm not saying that you can't ever do that, but definitely establishing the boundaries of when it's okay and when it's not. It goes along with that inconsistency of just your day-to-day handling them, of one day something might be fine and you've been ignoring it for weeks, and now all of a sudden it's a problem, and all of a sudden now you want to get after the horse, and the horse is completely caught off guard. You know, like, what in the world? I've been doing this for months, and now you're all of a sudden getting after me. They probably don't have a clue what it is you're getting on to them about. So, just setting those boundaries and being really consistent on everything you do.
Yeah.
Going in to catch a horse, the way you approach one initially, whether it's in a pen or a small trap, you know, a grass trap or something, or in a stall, the way you approach them the first time has a huge impact on the way they react to you the rest of the day. And a lot of people just want to be able to go catch their horse and not put much effort into it. And maybe they're easy to catch, but, you know, on this day, you go in to catch them and all of a sudden they turn their back on you. Well, that's a huge sign of disrespect out of the horse. And so people either know that that's disrespect and they want to go, into immediate disciplinary mode, or they don't have a clue and they just start kind of trying to chase the horse. But if that horse has never given you that problem before and he suddenly turns his back on you, there's a problem. So he doesn't feel good. He's irritable. Something's ouchy. You know, he's sore from the ride the day before, maybe. Just doesn't feel good. And if you don't take that time to kind of draw that horse to you instead of just either chasing him or spanking him on the butt because he was being disrespectful, you're gonna right away set a bad tone for the ride that day, and that horse is gonna kind of blow up and be upset, or he's just gonna, you know, if you just go catch him anyways and chase him around till you get him caught, he's gonna realize you're not really in it for him, and that he's more of just a tool, and he's not gonna be as appreciative or as accommodating at everything you ask of him. So those are probably some of the main mistakes I see. And real low level, but they have such a long-term implication on everything we do with a horse.
Well, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that people need to really keep their head on a swivel and pay attention to the horse's body language and the horse's, what the signals the horse is sending out at all times. And that, you know, right up into catching them, you know, they're going to tell you some things about how they're feeling that day before you ever try to throw that lead rope over their neck or whatever.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
So I'm going to ask this question probably a little bit differently where I'm going with this question is a little different than where I'm going to start. But how long is a horse's memory? And what I mean by that is how often do you need to ride them and be consistent with them for those lessons to stick and to stay with them?
That's a really good question too. It's the answer is, it depends. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a cop out, but they're all different. You know, they all have personalities, and just like raising kids, what works with one doesn't work with the other. And some of them pick up on things really fast and you're just like, holy cow, I cannot believe how smart and willing this horse is. And then you have horses, and we joke about it all the time, like, this sucker just woke up in a brand new world again today. Like, we got to start all over. He doesn't remember anything from yesterday. So those are definitely personality traits in a horse that you want to look at, you know, whether you're purchasing one or whether you already own him. And if you already own him and he is that kind of horse, it just takes a lot more work and it takes a lot more consistency. Eventually, it will stick with him. But every day might feel like it's a refresher course until he kind of settles into what his job is, you know. And this is where, if you are looking at buying a horse, especially if you're, you know, wanting to ranch and actually do a job, I always advise people, go for an older horse. Go for one. Even if it costs a little money, in the long run, it's worth it, because you can count on them and you can go do your job, versus a young horse that you're having to teach as you go. And maybe he's picking it up, maybe he's not picking it up, maybe he had never seen what you're asking of him, so he doesn't even know, you know, those sort of things. But as far as a smart horse, my wife jokes all the time, she hates a smart horse, because a smart horse, they are always thinking. And a smart horse can be difficult to train, because even though they pick up on things really quick, if you are not diligent in how you handle them from the moment you walk into their stall, just like I was saying a second ago about catching them, you know, they're learning, and they're learning if they can beat you or not. They are learning how to outthink you. So while it sounds really smart to have a horse like Trigger, you know, that can come when I whistle and knows all these tricks and stuff like that. You have to really watch those horses, because those horses will outthink you and try to figure out a way to beat you. Just, you know, sometimes out of fun and pleasure and enjoyment on their part, because it's a game. And sometimes, you know, just to get out of work. And so a good old horse that's just kind of even keeled, and maybe he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he's not dumb and he's not fighting yet. You know, those are easier horses to get along with, and they'll just kind of go do their job. The sexes actually play a huge part in that. I think stallions and mares tend to pay attention a lot more and are a little easier. Now, I'm going to sound contradictory for a minute, but I think that they're easier to train as far as what they learn and how fast they learn it. However, because of their sexual nature, they will tend to push back. Whereas a gelding has kind of had some of his inhibition, or some of his ambition taken away. He's a little more laid back, and he just doesn't seem to have quite the care. In my opinion, that makes him a little harder to train. Other people are going to disagree with that and say, no way, I hate mares. I'd rather never deal with a mare. But I'm telling you, some of the best horses I've ever ridden have been mares, as long as you don't fight with them. If you draw a line in the sand and go, no, this is going to happen, but you're not kicking and snatching and jerking on them. You're just saying, we're going to do this, and you just stay after them until it happens. And a stud can try to outdo you and outthink you, and he may be distracted by stuff outside of your realm or where you're training, if there's some mares across the fence or whatever. But a gelding seems like you have to just kind of keep pushing on him all the time. And then they can get a little cranky because they just want to go eat and they don't really care, that sort of thing. So those kind of all play into it as far as length of time. But as far as what you ask, as far as their length of memory, it also depends on how they learned what they learned. And if they learned what they learned in trauma, their memory can last forever, literally. And something that might seem really benign to us, but it scared them really bad, you know, say maybe when they were young, it'll stick with them, and it'll be a traumatic event for them for the rest of their life. And it may be something as simple as a lead rope dragging on the ground, or a piece of trash blowing on a barbed wire fence, that sort of thing. And then you'll have other horses that walk right by it and never see that kind of thing. And it goes back to how they were first exposed to it. Again, this along the same lines, training one, if you get into a sure enough fight with a horse where you're really having to kick on them or jerk on their face or whatever to get them to do whatever it is you want, you kind of short out for a minute and lose your temper. You know, we're all guilty of it. Nobody's proud of it. But just kind of in the heat of the moment, you can set them back for several weeks just on what they know. And again, I'm talking more about a green horse that's kind of in the phases of training versus an older horse. But an older horse will kind of remember those fights too, you know. So had horses that have been in wrecks. I was riding a young horse doctor in Yearlands, and this was a three-year-old that was going to kind of be a stock horse futurity project for me. I was pretty excited about her. She's really nice, coming along good. And I was doctoring Yearlands on her as a young three-year-old already out in the open, you know, roping stuff out in the open and tying Yearlands down and doctoring them out of medicine on my doctoring bags on the back of my saddle. And it was a wet day. It had been raining. In fact, we didn't get to start doctoring until 11 o'clock that morning because it had been raining so much and so hard. So we waited until 11. We were out there. The pastures are wet. I ended up getting after one that was pretty wild and it wouldn't just line out and run straight. And she's still young, so she's still learning, you know, so I had to track around a little longer than I would have on a broke horse. But as we tracked around, she kept slipping every time that calf would cut really hard. And long story short, we ended up slipping and falling down, and it was a bad wreck. I ended up with a broke leg. I ended up hung up in the stirrup for a minute, and she fell up on top of me, which is how my leg broke. And in all that wreck that, you know, happened in about probably 5 seconds total before it was over, once my broken leg healed up and we went back to work, the very next time, and it was probably 3 months later, the very next time I roped a yearling, everything was fine right up until the point I ripped my slack down tight. She ran to that cow. She rated. She stayed right there while I swung my rope and roped. And when I ripped my slack and asked her to stop and the rope started coming tight, she had a flashback episode, I guess you'd say. It had been 3 months. And she flipped out. She went to running off. It was bad because it was probably about a 5-weight yearling. And I was tied off because I'm down here in Texas, and that's what we do. We don't dally. We intend to keep what we catch no matter what. And she went to running off at a really bad angle. The yearling got behind me and was running off, and everything was about to come tight. And my horse was the one that was going to take the trip, not the yearling. And luckily, my partner was with me, and we were doctoring together that day, which doesn't always happen. We're usually by ourselves. But I went to squealing pretty loud like a third-grade girl, and he came whooping and riding to me and got there just in time to kind of haze that yearling and keep it from running in behind my horse while I got her to face up. I never really got her stopped, but at least got her faced up as the yearling hit the end of that rope and everything kind of came tight. But it the next three head that I roped, she had a come apart like that every time. So, you know, it just really depends on how they learned what they learned. So that's why you want to keep the learning environment calm and quiet. It doesn't mean that you're a pacifist and that you let them run over you and do what they want. It just means that you just keep showing them and you keep exposing them and you keep your expectations low until they suddenly get it. And then you can push on them and take them to the next level. But the more traumatic their learning experience is, the longer they will remember those bad episodes and they'll cling to that. And it sets your, you know, it sets your training back, whether it's a finished horse or a young horse. Like I said, this was a young horse, but this was a very nice young horse that I had high hopes for and ended up not being able to go the direction I wanted to go with her.
Yeah, that's really good stuff, David, and I really appreciate your time today. As you were talking there, I was thinking that maybe a gelding would be like a yes man, and a mare or a stallion would be that smart kid that asks, why are we doing it this way all the time, that you might get a little annoyed with, but you if you explain it to them, they'll get it, and they'll remember it forever. And you know, so I thought that might be a good illustration there.
That's a pretty good analogy. Yes, sir.
And I think maybe that wreck there, the second wreck, almost wreck, might be one of those instances you were referring to earlier where the Lord intervenes and has a guy with you that day where it doesn't turn out as bad as it could have.
Right. Yes. So definitely so.
I was going to try and give people some context about the nature of your work and your history with horses, but I think you've really done that with kind of some of these stories that you've told. But I guess if you want to share a little bit of your credential, that would be fine. And I think it would be beneficial as well.
Well, I consider myself a cowboy first. I mean, I am a working cowboy, and I realize that a lot of people may have different ideas in their heads about what that looks like. But what I am is I'm a horseback specialist. I don't build fence and I don't bale hay and I don't do any of that. I'm horseback all the time. And sometimes people will kind of like poo-poo that and say that doesn't really exist anymore, but I'm a day working cowboy. So I work for different ranches as they need it. The area that I live in currently, most places are fairly small, and so they don't have any kind of a crew. They might have a hired hand, but that hired hand probably just builds fence, and he probably doesn't know how to be horseback. And, you know, maybe they are able to pin their cows with a sack of feed, but every now and then they get those two or three yearlings that, you know, want to run off, or a couple of bad cows that need to go to the sale barn that they can't get them caught, and they'll call me. I use dogs, you know, as far as being able to help pin stuff like that too. And then, you know, I do work around the chute. You know, we'll drag calves in the spring and brand for people and vaccinate. And then in the fall, we'll pin and strip yearlings and load them on the truck and ship cattle like that. So that's kind of the main thing that I do aside from catching wild stuff. My preference is to doctor yearlings. I've done that quite a bit over the years of having, you know, either working for somebody or, you know, people have contracted me to go in and take care of a set of yearlings to where I'm just horseback, me and my dogs prowling through those cattle every day looking for sicks. And if they're sick, you know, then some places don't have pens at all and they definitely need me. And in those instances, that's where I rope and catch and tie down, and I've got the medicine on my saddle and I doctor them, you know, in place. And so I'm kind of halfway not claiming any kind of veterinary credentials. I talk to my vet. I talk to drug reps a lot as far as knowing what I'm using, the drugs I'm using. A lot of it will depend on the owner of the cattle and what he wants used, you know, what his drug prep program is. And I've got to follow his program, whether I agree with it or not, because he's the man paying the bills. But I'm not diminishing guys that build fence and haul hay and stuff. I'm just saying that's what I do. I'm horseback all the time. And that's kind of my specialty. So I kind of consider myself more of a, like a hired gun mercenary type, if you will. But, and then when during the off season, and it definitely is cyclical during the off season, I'm training horses. So I work here at my house and got arena and round pen and stalls, and I keep cattle here too for training horses on cattle. Generally I'm training more and helping people for like the rain cow horse, event. And, but sure. Trained lots of other stuff. I've had English jumping horses in here that people were having trouble with and kind of help with some problem stuff like that. And every now and then a barrel racer will send me one. So just anything really that it has to do with horses, that's kind of what I do.
Yeah, good. And you've undertaken recently to share some of that knowledge with people and give them some of the access to some of what you're doing to train horses. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we realized that I can't help everybody and that there's lots of people out there that need help and are frustrated. And when you start doing a search online, lots of stuff comes up. But we kind of decided to go that route and start an online membership and with training material. And kind of through videos and some written articles, just putting down what I do and my ideas and my philosophy on things to be able to help people that are maybe struggling. You know, there's a lot of big name guys that are out there doing that. And I've actually had people come to me and say, you know, I spent a lot of money on this guy's program, really slick, shiny marketing and DVDs and whole box set of DVDs. And when I got through with it, like I didn't understand it. And then there was nothing I could do. And that's kind of part of what I do with the membership that we started. It's more of a community where, like Facebook, it has a social media aspect to it where people can go in and talk to each other and ask questions. So, you know, because even myself, there's been books I've read by really well-known trainers and the language or the vocabulary, the way they describe something as I was reading it, I really couldn't understand exactly what they meant. And I read it, you know, four or five times, you know, and come back over the years and read it again and still maybe not exactly certain what they're now. Sometimes you come back and read that stuff after years or two have gone by and you're like, oh, I get it. But that's kind of what it's designed to be, more on a personal level of where I have these videos out there. Yes. And you can watch them. And if they help you, you know, you can go back to them again and again and again and see. And sometimes by watching them multiple times, you'll pick up on the nuances of what was happening, because I've been there too, where I've actually gone to a trainer and ridden and asking for help. And he's guiding me and he's saying, now pull here and squeeze there. And I'm like, I'm doing that. And the horse still won't respond. And the guy's like, well, you know, just keep at it. What I've learned over the time is there are some really minute subtleties with horses because they are so sensitive, that those subtleties is usually where the disconnect is for the people and the horse. And so, you know, if you're watching my videos and it just doesn't make sense and you're not figuring it out, you just get on the forums and shoot a question out there. I'll sure get on there and try to walk through with what you're doing. And it may not be the actual maneuver itself. It may actually be something ahead of the maneuver, something you did before you got there that was maybe miscommunication or confusing the horse or something like that. Or, you know, the horse just didn't have the skill set required. You know, the steps one and two might have been there, but maybe at some point step three got skipped and you're trying to work on step five. Well, it's really critical to go back and fill in steps three and four in order for step five to work, you know, that sort of thing. And those are real vague terms. I get it, but there's so many different combinations that when it comes to dealing with a horse of commands and cues and what it's, you know, unfortunately the owner's manual with those guys is not real detailed.
Yeah. Well, and just really, really good stuff. And really appreciate your time. What's the nature of some of the videos that people could expect to find on your membership site?
Well, we started out pretty basic, just trying to help, you know, the person maybe that's just new and brand new. Well, I mean, I've got how to saddle your horse and how to put a bridle on and how to tie a rope halter and things like that, which is surprising. I went on a camping hunting trip with some buddies of mine in the mountains in Colorado one year. And these are guys that had kind of been around horses most of their lives. And I hauled a horse up there and we rented some horses from an outfitter and a guide and then trailered them around and went in into an area where he didn't normally go. So he just let us take those horses. And we literally hadn't been on the trail 10 minutes and we stopped to get water. And when everybody was getting mounted back up, we had this big wreck and horses were rearing up and flipping over. And of course that caused a chain reaction and all those horses. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to die up here. Of course, my horse is the only one being good and the whole deal. And he was even starting to get a little bit worried and panicked with as much commotion going on. And I just happened to look over at this guy's bit and it was the most medieval looking thing I had ever seen. Of course, it came from the guide. You know, I thought, what did this guy send us with? This thing had these big old long shanks and they curved forward and kind of almost pointed up in the air and had this big chain going over the top of the horse's nose. And suddenly it hit me. He had put that bit in that horse's mouth upside down.
Oh, wow.
And this is a guy that literally grown up around horses. My dad had horses. I've ridden horses all my life, but you know, he didn't do it regularly. And he literally put a great big old long shank grazing bit in a horse's mouth upside down with the curb chain going over his nose. Oh, and he was the guy that caused the wreck, because when he stepped up on this horse and it went to walk off and he pulled really hard, you can imagine what kind of pressure he put on that horse's face that horse was not used to. And so, yeah, as easy as it sounds to put a bridle on a horse, apparently it's pretty critical that we talk about those things.
Yep.
And well, then I go into more. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say the subtleties of approaching the horse and even order of operations when you're putting things on, you know, that can set the, like you said earlier, set the tone for the whole day.
And we've got more advanced stuff in there. The people that started joining right away were actually more advanced and were competing in rein cow horse. And they, you know, there's not a lot of cow expertise out there. And being that I am a working cowboy, it suddenly dawned on me. I was actually at a clinic and we were putting on this clinic, and people kept doing the same thing over and over with the way they approached a cow. And it dawned on me that I've seen the same thing when I'm day working, you know, when the owner is out there trying to help us with his own cattle and trying to, you know, wave his arms in the air and shoo a cow through a gate or get it to turn around, and the cow just puts her head down and blows snot on him as she runs by him. And so I actually started writing some articles about the psychology of cattle, you know, to be able to help people that aren't necessarily around cattle enough to be able to read a cow. Because you go to a lot of horse trainers and they talk about reading a cow, and they'll start talking about things like which way he's flicking his ear and stuff. And I'm talking about overall reading the whole body language of the cow and what, you know, what works and what doesn't work and when it will work and when it won't work. And so, you know, more advanced stuff on how to work a cow, how to position your cow. And it doesn't just apply to the arena for the show guys. It definitely, you know, there's stuff in there that will help a person that's ranching and, you know, trying to pin their own cows, stuff like that.
Absolutely. Stock or stock wherever they're at. So
that's exactly right.
Very, very good stuff. Where would people go to find some of that training material and join up and be part of your membership site? And like you were saying earlier, really the benefit of that is the back and forth opportunity there to ask your questions and get them answered.
Yes, sir. Definitely. The website is A Texas Cowboy. It's all run together. atexascowboy.com. And, within that A Texas Cowboy, there's a blog that where I've written, you know, some of my wild stories from past cowboy and wrecks and things like that. And more recent times, the articles have been geared more toward training, and some videos in there that are a little bit just kind of a nuggets of what's in the membership. The membership is actually within that website, and it's called the Everyday Horseman Community. And that's where you would go to look into that. The website has the blog. Because I also have a broodmare band, so I've got horses for sale listed on the website as well. And, you know, of course, there's a little bit about me, background and stuff, but then the actual membership community is what's called the Everyday Horseman Community. And then as far as just a taste of, you know, of what it all looks like in general, is my Facebook page is also, the fan page is also A Texas Cowboy on Facebook. And that I put a lot more short stuff, clips of things, you know, kind of day to day. There's a few lives where I've gone live when I'm working my dogs, or, you know, when we're pinning a set of cows. Sometimes I forget, I get busy, because I do take my job seriously. And I want to act professional, as professional as any lawyer or doctor would. I take it serious, and I have a lot of pride in that. So I'm not always able to pull my phone out and capture a video in the heat of battle. And sometimes I miss some really cool stuff and I kick myself later, but it was more important to me at the moment to do my job right versus being like this younger generation, have a phone out trying to catch everything that's happening instead of taking care of business. So.
Very good. Yep. And there's some really great videos up there on the Facebook page that will be linked in the show notes page at workingcows.net/113. workingcows.net/113 is the show notes page for today. And we'll have links to David's website and his Facebook page. And I'll link to a pretty cool video of him pinning some yearlings with his dogs. And someday in the future, we'll get you back on and we'll talk about working cows with dogs and how you got started with that and how you use them on a day-to-day basis.
You bet. If you thought I was long-winded on horses, boy, I really get long-winded talking about dogs.
Well, I look forward to it, David, and thanks for your time today.
You bet, Clay. Thank you very much for having me.
Be sure to check out workingcows.net/113 today. Show notes page for today, workingcows.net/113. There'll be links to the Everyday Horseman community as well as David's Facebook page and some of that stuff as well. So check that out. And I'm looking forward to next week and really excited to be bringing on Dave Pratt, who is now an emeritus position with Ranching for Profit. And we're going to talk to David Pratt about some of the things that are really exciting him in this new transition, as well as some of the things he learned over 25 plus years of managing ranch management consultants. So don't miss that episode 114 with David Pratt, formerly of Ranch Management Consultants, on the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.